Tú me pones un éxito. Si tú no quieres hablar conmigo, dímelo para yo no llamarte ni molestarte, porque nada más quedaba tú.
Real talk, real people, real stories. The He's Just Podcast. Yeah! Welcome, everyone, to another He's Just Podcast. I'm your host and founder of the He's Just a Social Worker Movement with another amazing show for you today. But before we get started, I want to remind everyone that this platform was built because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. But this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Grief, it is the deep emotional pain and mourning experience in response to a significant loss. Meet Rachel Zimmerman, an award-winning journalist with over two decades of experience covering health and medicine. She is a contributor to the Washington Post. She previously worked as a staff writer for the Wall Street Journal and served as a health reporter for WUR, Boston's public radio station, where she co-founded a popular blog and podcast. Her essays and reporting have been featured in the New York Times, Vogue.com, New York magazines, The Cut, O, The Oprah Magazine, The Atlantic, Slate, and The Huffington Post, among others. She holds an MS from Columbia University, Graduate School of Journalism, and a BA from Sarah Lawrence College. Today, we discuss her new book, Us After, a memoir of love and suicide. Rachel, welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having me on.
We are so excited. It is such a deep and beautiful story, yours. But we want to get started. Introduce yourself and tell us a little bit about what you're currently working on.
Well, so the book is basically the story of my husband, Seth Teller's suicide 10 years ago on July 1st, 2014. And really, it's the story, as the title says, about my daughters and I coming back to life, rebuilding our family after his death. And the us after, people have asked, who's us? And the us is my kids and me. You know, we became this unit. And in some ways, it's my husband who died, you know, and our evolving relationship. I mean, you know, just because someone dies, it doesn't mean your relationship with that person ends, right? It evolves, obviously, it changes, obviously, but they don't disappear from your consciousness. So it's the story of me as a journalist trying to understand something that is so incomprehensible, suicide. I mean, it goes against all of our basic human instincts, right, to survive. And it's also about sort of pivoting from an investigation about why he died, what I could have done to stop it, to how do I live a good and fulfilling life and give that to my daughters, you know, and find pleasure and joy again. So that's the book. I still do a lot of freelance reporting. As you said, I write about mental health. I contribute stories to the Washington Post, and I do freelance reporting. I'm working on a new project, a novel about inherited trauma in families. But right now I'm just sort of doing a lot of events around this book.
We're going to dive deeper into the book. And first and foremost, I wanted to say and send my condolences because I understand the world of grief myself. And it's totally one that continues to unfold daily. It's something that
absolutely,
we continue to live through. So sending you and your daughters positive energy. I can't help but say that I've sipped through the book. It's amazing, well told, lovely how it was written, but I connected with it immediately with the title Us, and I looked at it for all of us who have dealt with grief. So thank you for sharing that and that beautiful title. I want to talk a little bit more about your journey as a writer, because before you became this amazing journalist and your life kind of changed, tell us a little bit about your journey and your walk and how you got started.
Right. Well, I actually, in college, was not a journalist. I was a writer. I did poetry. You know, it was a different time. We weren't as directed to, you know, figure out a career. And I started working in publishing, and I worked at a publishing company in San Francisco. And that company also owned the San Francisco Chronicle. So I started writing book reviews, and I sort of liked having work published in the newspaper. And I had a friend who worked at a tiny newspaper in Hollister, California, which is kind of between near Monterey, inland, a little town, you know. And so I went and worked there, and I covered city council meetings where the council members like wore guns to the meetings. And it was like very old Wild West California. Like, they thought I was Italian because there were no Jewish people that they had ever met in this county. So, and I had, you know, born and raised in New York City and going out to this California situation, it was eye-opening. So I did that for a while. And then actually when David Dinkins was elected mayor, I had some people who were like family friends who I grew up with who were working in that administration. And I actually was a speechwriter for the then Parks Commissioner, Betsy Gottbaum, left California. And actually, I wrote speeches for Dinkins for a while, too, because we were sort of rotating out of the office. But then I realized I really wanted to be a journalist. So I, as you said, I went to Columbia for journalism school, and then just kind of worked my way up from, you know, an alternative weekly in Portland, Oregon, to a paper, a small business journal in Portland again, then to the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, which doesn't exist anymore. I was as a political reporter. And then when the Wall Street Journal opened a Seattle bureau to cover local regional news, I got hired there. So I started covering, you know, the Northwest, and then an opening appeared in the main part of the journal in New York City. And that's where I began covering health and medicine. I first started writing about sort of the politics of drug pricing. And it was when there was a lot of discussion and turmoil over the high cost of HIV/AIDS drugs, particularly in countries that most needed them and that couldn't afford the incredibly, ridiculously astronomical prices. So I covered the politics of drug pricing for a while. And then more generally, I started covering health and medicine. And then after I had my kids, I started working for the public radio station in Boston, WBUR, where I had a health blog. And I really started covering personal health and women's health and children's. You know, it was kind of like what I was living, I was covering. And so, you know, back to the book, in some ways, as I said, you know, if you know anyone who has experienced the suicide of a loved one, I think feels personally, what could I have done to stop this, right? And so for me, you know, as a spouse of someone, you feel like I, you know, woke up with this person for, you know, 15 years. What did I miss? But also as a health reporter, you know, a professional observer, I felt like I really missed the signs. We can get into that more, but that's kind of the shorthand of my writing journey.
Before we dig in, I first want to get it out the way. You and I began our chat. Brooklyn is in the
house. Totally Brooklyn. Yep.
So I want to make sure that's out there clearing the grounds. You've done amazing work. Kudos to you, and claps out for sure.
Thank
you. Tell us a little bit about how your journey through grief kind of reshaped your understanding of your husband and your life together. Not the situation after it unfolded, but the aftermath of grief. How did that reshape your understanding?
Yeah, well, let me just back up a bit to answer that question and to tell you a little bit about Seth. He was a devoted father to our kids, who were 8 and 11 years old when he died, two girls. He was a brilliant, beloved professor at MIT. He taught robotics, tenured professor. He was close to his parents, his extended family. You know, he was, you know, political in the neighborhood association where we lived. So in other words, he had a very robust social network, like, and he didn't have the usual warning signs that we think of with people who are deeply depressed and suicidal, right? He wasn't socially alienated. He didn't have a long history of addiction. He, you know, was a high functioning person with his actually dream job and a strong marriage and beautiful daughters. So this really, in many ways, came out of the blue, you know, and I believe all death in some way is a shock to our system, right? My 91-year-old uncle died 2 weeks ago, and he was 91 and he had a beautiful life. And in fact, a quick, you know, painless death. But still, you know, your brain is used to this person being there to pick up the phone, to wake up next to you, and then suddenly they're not. And your brain takes a while to get used to that. And then, you know, in my case with Seth and a suicide, as I said, there's just something incomprehensible. And so the initial grief, you know, when I first heard the news, a state trooper came to my door and told me the news that Seth was dead. And my first thought was about my kids. And I just started screaming, the girls, because I just felt like their childhood had been ended, that we would never recover. You know, that even that afternoon, the first day he died, my older daughter said to me, "Will we ever be happy again?" And I told her yes, but I completely didn't believe it. I thought, how do kids recover from this? You know, we're doomed. I basically felt that deeply. And as you know, as anyone knows who has been through grief, there are not tidy stages of grief. Like, that whole theory has been largely debunked. You do have experiences of those phases, but they're not linear. They're not contained. You know, you may feel regret and loss and anger and bargaining, and then you may go back and start all over again. Or you may feel like you're suddenly getting your bearing and you can go out into the world again. And then, you know, sometimes I'll see somebody on a bike who has the same body shape as Seth, and I just get like pulled back into it, you know, even 10 years later. So I think grief is extremely individual. It's doesn't progress in a tidy way where you sort of go through it and then you're done. It evolves and it comes in waves. And I think, you know, part of writing this book, you know, a sort of a 10-year process, is me coming to figure out a story about Seth's death that I could live with, you know. And that was, I've always been a writer. I think of the world when things happen, I think, ooh, what would that be, a story, or what kind of story would that make? And so, in fact, just a few days after he died, in my crazy grief-stricken, you know, rut brain running and looping and trying to figure out what I could have done, I thought, well, this is a terrible story, but it is a story. And I did start taking notes for a project. I had no idea what would come of it, but it's sort of my natural impulse to start writing things down.
I loved how you broke down the process of grief, because yes, it is not linear. It's so different and indifferent and unjust in so many ways. For those of us who experience, and we all have in some way, shape, or form, whether with a person, a pet, or what have you, loss is incredible to kind of deal with. For me, when you talked about the signs, leaning into it just a bit, there were really no signs. You know, Seth, 50 years old, up and coming, had his life all in front of him. I read early of how he showed joy for your daughters. He would be happy. There was nothing about that kind of had you. He'll tuck him in the bed. He'll drive him around his job and make sure that everything was going well. For me, the signs, and that was the part that saddened me the most for you, because I said, that's not fair to her. And now having to deal with the breakdown, and you bargained so long with, Do I lie to the kids? No, I don't. I have to call my therapist. Do I tell this? Do I start here? Do I not lie? Do I say the truth? How do I express it? So I just, in those early stages of the book, I was like, wow, this woman is a superpower, because there's so much that we, us that have dealt with this, cannot see. Whether the person is 50, 91, 108, the feelings that we go through are immeasurable. So we stay, you know, connected in that way. And unfortunately, we must continue to live. And through your daughters, you will continue to live that legacy. I want to touch a bit about some of the scenarios, like that process of you trying to seek answers. I know how difficult this was for you, because the writer, the journalist, the investigator in you, you're like, this can't be right. So you started researching MIT. You started researching, why do people go through this? Was he overstressed at work? Walk us through there.
Yeah. So as a journalist, I sort of had experience of, you know, facing a complex problem, finding the experts who know about that problem, you know, interviewing as many people as I can who can enlighten me, and eventually, you know, come up with some kind of resolution. And that's when you start writing the story, right? And so with this situation, I thought, okay, if I talk to enough people, if I talk to the right people, if I talk to all of his friends and anybody who was ever his doctor, and, you know, I even found a guy who jumped off the same bridge as Seth, but who survived. I talked to him because I thought maybe he can enlighten me. Maybe he can tell me what he was thinking in those last moments. And, you know, I didn't have that aha moment, like, this is going to unlock the mystery. You know, it wasn't like Seth had gambled away all our money or had this affair that was secret, or there, I almost wanted a secret that I discovered so then it would be like, aha, now I get it. There was nothing like that. But in interviewing and researching and talking and reading all about this topic, I did learn a few things. What I share with my kids and what I have come to believe is that he had an illness in his brain, right? Mm-hmm. And just like cancer, he didn't choose to abandon his family. You don't say someone commits cancer, right? They get cancer, there are renegade cells in their bodies, and some cancer leads to death. And in that same way, the upshot of this illness he had in his brain, whether it was, you know, debilitating depression, perhaps untreated bipolar disorder, whatever it was, it wasn't a selfish choice that he made, which is still what many people think. People said to me, aren't you angry at him for mm-hmm. leaving you? Mm-hmm. And I was at the outset angry, not at him, but I was angry about the situation I found myself in. But I think something common among people who die by suicide is this feeling that the world would be better off without them. Which, of course, shows their profound lack of perspective. But I think it is something that is common. And the other thing I've learned is that to be in that suicidal state, you're in this kind of tunnel vision, right? And you're not thinking about your kids. You're not thinking about your family. You are only thinking about the psychological pain you're in and how to get out of it, right? And somebody compared it, you know, to a burning building where you see no way out, except by jumping. And so to your point, the investigating didn't do what I thought it would do, but it did help me better understand this illness that he had and what he felt he had to do. And I just want to go back to one other point. I did struggle over what to tell the kids. That was a huge part of, like, what information do I give them? When do I tell them? They were, you know, at first I thought, okay, they're two kids. I give them all the same information. But honestly, an 8-year-old developmentally is different than an 11-year-old. And my kids, just personality-wise, were very different. So for instance, the younger one wanted many details. She started asking, exactly how did daddy die? I want all the details. And the older one was kind of like, I don't need you to go through that with me. She kind of wanted to have this memory of him that was an older, purer memory and didn't need me to do that. So I started to realize that, first of all, developmentally, they need different information. And secondly, just as different human beings, they needed different stuff. And you said I lied. I didn't really lie to, I don't feel like I lied to them. There were bits of information that I didn't tell them for some time, but whenever they asked, I told them what they asked about. So, you know, that first day, I found out at about 11:30 in the morning that he was dead, and my kids were at day camp, and I had till 3 p.m. to figure out what to tell them. And I had no idea. But again, as a journalist, one thing that I am capable of doing is find somebody who knows how to deal with complexity. So I, you know, called my journalist friend and I said, I need someone to give me a script because I have no idea what to tell the girls. And I was lucky enough to have this incredible psychiatrist from Massachusetts General Hospital call me. And I, you know, I said, I need a script. And she walked me through. She said, don't lie to them. Don't give them tons of detail. Just make it very clear that you are here for them and you will muddle through this together. And then this is very painful. It will get better. And you are here. And that's what I did. And, you know, that was sort of the ongoing message, which changed as they grew up. And I did give them more information as they were ready for it.
I want to, again, reiterate, I said you were in the middle of your thoughts. Do I lie? Do I not lie? Do I say the truth? And that's where I was coming from.
Right, right. That's accurate. Yeah.
That whole process, though, is one that plays tricks on us for sure. And before anything, I just want to reach out for any families and listeners who are struggling with this. Please remember the Suicide Crisis Lifeline, 988 or text 988. For those that need the support, even when you feel a person is living their best self, we have seen and read so many actors and people who look like they're living their best lives and they're dealing with things that sometimes they want to alleviate family members from. Their thought process get kind of entangled in different thoughts. So prayers and positive energy always to families who are dealing with this, and make sure that you call the hotline for supports. That's 988, text 988. Yes. In what ways did motherhood intersect for you with grief? And how did you navigate doing that while managing your emotions, yet supporting your daughters?
Right. I mean, so you're both, you know, trying to be a comfort and managing their grief while you're managing your own. And so, you know, I've said that even in our very unlucky circumstances, we were pretty lucky. And the reason, the many reasons we were lucky, basically came down to community and support. So Seth had left life insurance, which I wasn't sure I was going to get because they have this suicide clause and it's, you know, it was touch and go there for a while. But we did get that money, which gave us financial security so that we didn't have to move out of the house we were living in. The kids could stay in their school that they had been at since they were four. So I can't, you know, overestimate the value of just material comfort to keep us stable, right? But also the community of other moms who rallied around me and, you know, drove the kids to gymnastics and to birthday parties and wherever they needed to go. They brought me food and just left it at the doorstep. They answered my calls in the middle of the night when I was anxious or freaking out about anything. And, you know, it wasn't always the people I expected to rise up to that who did. And on the other hand, it was also some people who were just sort of peripheral friends who just came right in and were there for me. So that was huge. And I realized just how important that was when my younger daughter and I went to a grief group where the kids, it was for some people, families who had lost a loved one, and the children were downstairs and they didn't talk about grief and loss. They, you know, jumped on a trampoline and did art projects and painted rocks, whatever they did. And then the grownups were upstairs talking. And I saw women mostly who didn't have the security and the community I had, and they did have to move away from their kids' friends and their families, and you know, that destabilized things. And they couldn't take time off from work, for instance, because they had like bad bosses who didn't get it. And that just makes that compounds the trauma, right? Like that's a re-traumatization of a moment where you just need support. And if you don't have it, it just makes everything worse. And honestly, you know, there are a couple of men in my group, and they, you know, one of them said, "I've never made a sandwich for my kid before. I don't know what to do." You know, he was lost. And another was sort of like, "I don't know what to tell a teenage girl about the death of her mother." So in other words, I saw people who didn't have that support really struggling even more than, you know, beyond the grief of the death. So community was everything. And my children felt it too. They felt very supported. And one thing we did, so you mentioned he had just turned 50 2 months before he died. So we had had a 50th birthday party for him. And I just need to say, this guy did not look like an MIT professor. He would often teach classes in shorts. He came off as this like laid back. He played ultimate frisbee. He had a bottle of bubble mix that he kept in the back of the car with a wand. And so if he ever ran into a bunch of kids or if he was in a park, he'd just like start making bubbles. He had a very childlike demeanor, you know, on some level. But as a friend of mine said to me after reading the book, she said, it was like Seth had a PhD in hiding. And I think there was so much pressure that he put upon himself to succeed at a very high level. And, you know, there was no margin for error. And so, you know, it was unrealistic expectations that when certain things started happening. So, you know, he turned 50, he developed a little sciatica, so he couldn't do his exercise. Like he couldn't play ultimate frisbee. He had tinnitus, which is a ringing in the ear that was just mild for years, and it escalated. He was in the middle of a big international robotics competition that he desperately wanted to win. I mean, I would say to him, you know, you have tenure at MIT, like, does it really matter if you win this contest? And he would just explode and say, of course it matters. I have to win. You know, he was super ambitious and competitive in that way. So again, not the typical warning signs, but these other signs that coalesced. And he had no coping skills really, because he hadn't been in long-term therapy. But one of the things that we did for him when he turned 50 was have this raucous party with kids in the front yard and playing capture the flag and super casual grilling, et cetera. And one of the things we did a year after he died, you know, I started getting tired of being miserable. And it was a beautiful, sunny Saturday, and it was coming up on the first year. And I said to my kids, what if we had another birthday party for Dad? And they just were like, really? That's weird. He's not here. How do we have? But they came around, and we ultimately put together a party of the same people who had come to his actual 50th birthday party. Everybody came, and it was a beautiful, you know, commemoration of his life, and that we had all survived together. And we actually did that for the next 4 years. Same people, you know, different. We would read and we would make toasts, and, you know, we would update each other on what all our kids were doing. But it became this ritual that was sort of a tangible reminder of this community that had saved us.
Amazing stuff, Rachel. And once again, you turn this upside down, even dealing with, you were able to kind of see yourself through making positives where negatives really, really lived. And you made sure that you kept your daughters afloat. And one of the areas, your two beautiful daughters who we would like to know a little bit more about, one line that had me going, one says, I'm not even double digits yet. There was so much to like, look at that. That was so difficult. But again, it just shows you that you needed to put that fight in, because you said, you know what, even if it's not for me, these two guys, I'm not going to sell them short. Tell us a little bit about them as much as you can. I know that in the book, they wanted to keep their names and everything correct. But as far as everyone else, you kind of protected. Can you tell me a little bit about your two great daughters?
Yes, I would be honored to do that. Yes, they, you know, in terms of consent, they read the manuscript before it was published, and I gave them the option of changing their names, and they were, you know, they were behind it, and they said that I could use their names, et cetera. You know, now they're both in college. One's a senior, the other's a freshman, and I'm doing all these book events. They came to the launch party, but they're like, do we have to come to everything, you know? So I think one of the amazing things about how kids absorb grief is they do it on their own time, and it's not on adult time. They only take in what they can, and they incorporate it into their own stories. And I have a section about, you know, how surprising it is. You know, anyone who has kids, when your kids come home and tell you something you don't already know, it's kind of shocking. And so when my kids started, when I would hear them tell stories about their relationship with their father or how they managed through that time, that wasn't the way I remembered it or framed it. It was kind of amazing. It was like, wow, you have your own story and you've come up with the story you can live with. And you know, there's a scene in the book where my older daughter, they both were theater kids. And my older daughter did this performance piece where, you know, this chorus of boys were the voice of Seth. And she recounted this moment where she fell into a pool because she and Seth were playing ball on the side of the pool, and he threw it too far and she fell in and she couldn't swim. And she was waiting for him to save her. And it was kind of about like, he could save her then, but now he can't save her. And, you know, she said to me, bring tissues, which was a good thing to have said. But, you know, she started creating art out of tragedy. And, you know, and both of them, you know, I remember my younger kid when she was like 9 or 10, they had this thing where they would get up in a school assembly and recite a poem. And one of the poems Julia recited started out, if Little Red Riding Hood had a dad, maybe things wouldn't have been so bad. And all the moms are like looking at me, like she chose this poem. I didn't have anything to do with it, but she thought it was kind of clever, you know? And so they make their way and, you know, they both have healthy relationships. They have, you know, people who they're very close to. They have causes and passions. You know, my younger daughter called me the other day and said, you know, there are flags lining the path to the dining hall for Suicide Awareness Month. And all they say is, you are loved. Do you think they could do a little bit more than that? Like she's very attuned to what's out there for people. And, you know, they've become very empathetic kids. And I, you know, would never, ever wish this experience on anybody and anybody's children. But when you go through this as a young child, you know, it's life altering and your perspective shifts. And they have deep awareness about what suicide does to families. And the one message, you know, I've said to them, if there is a message out of this whole disaster, it's really that it's a sign of strength to ask for help, not a sign of weakness. And I do think that they have internalized that. And I also think, you know, I would like to mention, I think there's a gender thing here too, because I, you know, as much as we're all out there on social media and everybody talks about everything, I still think for men, there's something, you know, there's a societal shame about asking for help, expressing your true feelings, if they're not, you know, the perfectly curated feelings that we see on social media. And for Seth, you know, he was the one who people went to for help. He didn't reach out for help. And he was very like, pick yourself up by the bootstraps. And I think to his detriment, you know?
Mm. You know, I tell you what, there is so much beauty in the life that you have curated for yourself, for your beautiful daughters, the opportunity of chance and lesson that continues to happen. You've done a phenomenal job, not only career-wise, but also as a mom. These two guys are growing up just like powerhouses. It's amazing to kind of hear. I want to, you know, just touch base on the fact that now that your book is here, it's important that we kind of touch base on that. I've already uploaded on my website, so the links are up there. Let's talk about Us After, the memoir of love and suicide. Tell us why this was so important. And I know you worked extremely hard to put this together, but why was this important to you?
Well, as I said, you know, I sort of see life events as stories. And, you know, I think frequently about that famous Joan Didion quote, you know, we tell ourselves stories in order to live. And again, this is my attempt to come up with a story that I could live with. And I will say, you know, people have asked me, was writing this book like therapy for you? Mm. And the answer to that is not really. I mean, so, you know, writing a memoir is not just sort of converting your journal entries into book form, right? Mm-hmm. You know, writing a memoir involves creating characters and a narrative arc, and you have to figure out which details serve the story and which to leave out. So there's a lot of craft involved. And, mm-hmm. you know, I think that's part of the reason it took me so long to finish it and get it out into the world, because it's not a journal entry. It's not just sort of dumping your feelings, because who would want to read that, right? Like, mm-hmm. you've got to tell a story. And I will tell you something that I share in the book, which is a friend of mine who's a doctor. She was an internal medicine doctor, and she quit primary care because she was so disgusted with the U.S. healthcare system, mm-hmm. particularly in the fact that it had lost humanity in that people no longer were able to tell their stories, right? Like 15-minute appointments, in and out. There's no bond between doctor and patient that's real, you know, that's left. So she started this nonprofit called Health Story Collaborative, where she let people going through serious illness and loss tell their stories. So right after Seth died, she said to me, you know, do you want to come over and I'll just record you? It was kind of open-ended. So for the entire school year, the first year after he died, every week I went to her house and recorded. I just rambled, like, this is what I'm frustrated about. This is what I'm scared of. This is what we're going through. And about a year or so later, I listened to all the tapes again. And what I realized is that the early tapes, my very, you know, even the sound of my voice was raw and scratchy, and I wasn't finishing sentences and I was rambling. And then by the end, I was like calmer and thinking more clearly, thinking in a more grounded way. And I thought, okay, this is a story that I want to tell, because I never thought I would from here get to here. Mm-hmm. And I thought this is important for people who are at the beginning. I mean, I have people who call me, you know, with a very recent death, and I remember, you know, that stuff stays in your body, right? And you don't ever think you're going to recover, but you most often you do. And it takes a long time, and it's not how you imagine, but you do. And so I think that's why it was important to me. And, you know, while I'm doing these book events, and as you said at the top, like, everybody's got a loss. It's hard to be an adult without suffering some kind of loss or trauma, mm-hmm. not necessarily this, what I experienced, but something. And so everybody's got a story and they want to share their stories. And I think, you know, one of the amazing aspects of putting this out into the world is what comes back. And, you know, this sense of human connection over these hard stories. And I think it really makes us more human to share these difficult stories.
We are definitely blessed that you have taken the time and the years to put the effort to dedicate your personal life to help others. And in that, I mean, whoever gets an opportunity to meet you is one. Those that get to meet you and also read the book, that's a bonus because they get an opportunity to see and hear through your wordplay how things played out. But at the same time, although your experience may be different than others, what are some tips or strategies that you can tell our listeners who may are, you know, might be struggling with this?
Right.
May
right.
come up with this. What are some things that you think right. that you can share?
Right. I'd be happy to do that. I want to say, you know, you make it seem like I sort of am this miracle worker, which I completely am not. And I think one thing that was important to me in the book was to show that I am not a perfect mother. I was not a perfect wife. Like, nobody's perfect. Like, I yell at my kids sometimes and I make decisions I regret. And, you know, when our kids were really right. And when our kids were small, we were both sleep deprived and Seth and I fought, you know, so mm-hmm. I really included a bunch of stuff that shows my imperfections because I wanted people to relate, you know. And again, I was lucky because I had all these researchers and doctors who I could call up and say, can you just talk to me about this issue? And why can't we prevent, why are we not better at preventing suicide, et cetera? So what I would say is, I think that everybody needs to go at their own pace, number one. You know, I grew up in New York, like a lot of people were in therapy that I knew growing up. So I, of course, thought, I'm going to send my kids to therapy immediately. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my 11-year-old was kind of like, okay, you want me to sit in some, you know, middle-aged lady's office and talk about my dead father? No, thank you. So she just, you know, was not going to do that. And the little one, you know, came with me to this grief group. And that was what was appropriate, not sitting in an office, but playing with other kids and doing art projects with kids her own age who had also lost someone. And she said to me, you know, even as an 8-9-year-old, I didn't realize that other people had gone through this and this, you know, that it was helpful in that way. So I think there are, I think for some people, groups are really helpful to, you know, reinforce this idea that you're not alone mm-hmm. and, you know, to talk to people who get what you're going through because nobody, you know, if you haven't been through it, it's very hard and people try to say something kind, but there's no word really that fixes mm-hmm. it. And so it's a, can be an awkward situation, right? But if you're in a room with somebody who's also lost a spouse or, you know, a family member, there is a sense of like, you can exhale. So mm-hmm. I think groups are really helpful. I think everyone should be in therapy, frankly. And if you can find someone who takes your insurance and there's not a long waiting list, I think, you know, just venting and getting your feelings out in the open about it can be super helpful. I just think, you know, that it does take time. And I think surrounding yourself with people who have your best interest at heart, not necessarily, you know, I write a little bit about the people I expected to come and support me who didn't. I mean, there was a colleague who I was very close to. And she just said to me straight out, you know, I cannot deal with all the pain you're in. I just can't deal with it, which, wow, that hurt. But, you know, okay, that was her reality and she couldn't deal with it. Whereas people who weren't even close friends of mine became just that. And, you know, were kind of like, tell me where you want me to be. I'm picking up your kid. I'm taking her to Taekwondo. I'm feeding her and I'll bring her back, you know, just say when and where. So I had my kids later in life. I was older. I was in my late 30s when I had my first kid, and I had my career. And so I kind of thought I was one of those wise older moms who could sort of go it alone. But I quickly realized I am going to need help, you know, raising these two kids by myself. And I had to pivot. And I think, you know, we're not, sometimes we don't want to ask for help from our friends. You know, we feel like it's too much. They have their own lives, but they want to help. I mean, honestly, if you give someone a task when you're suffering and grieving, people are very happy to help. They want to do something. So I would say, you know, support, ask for help, have, you know, just know that the worst of it passes. And you have to find things that make you feel good, you know, whether it's doing yoga or being out in nature or saying, you know, I was scheduled to have people over to, you know, for dinner, but I'm canceling because I just need to be alone. And I think people understand that kind of response. And just knowing that it's a process and it takes time and there are no tidy stages.
I mean, to just recap a bit, you know, show them pace and show them grace. I love the tips about having the support groups. And the reason why we keep lifting you up on this platform is because many of us do go through the grief process, and we all will at some given point. Some of us deal with it one way, some deal with it another, but you use your abilities, you use your gift to do something about it. Yeah, you were not perfect, but you found something that not only was useful for others to know, but for me is an important tool that others should have. When you're dealing with grief and these layers, so much mental health, so much disbelief in thyself and things that come up for one another is so different. Big up to the community that supported you and those out there who are supporting mothers and families who are struggling through this. So it will take a village, and we have to stay, you know, together to do this. Tell me now, if you had an opportunity, and I know that those of us who've lost, I have lost my mom, and many a times those who hear my podcast, I start off with my mom. That's her telling me off about $100 I sent her, and she's like, I don't need your money. You can take it back. Others have said, oh, it's so nice you have your mom. I said, no, she was telling me off, basically. Nevertheless, I want you to, you know, use an opportunity here now that this is out. And if you had an opportunity to tell Seth something about this, what would you say right now to him?
I would just talk to him about how beautiful the girls are. And, you know, as I said, there were moments where I've been angry and moments of regret, many moments of regret. But I would just say how extraordinary our kids are and that they have parts of him. You know, my younger daughter plays ultimate frisbee. She's on the team at college. And I watched her play last year. And it was just, it blew my mind how she moves exactly how he moved. Oh, like, God. They're both sort of, he was kind of compact and sort of short, and she's compact and short, and they both have this amazing ability to just like sprint out of nowhere and like jump higher than you would think someone of their height could jump. So it was just uncanny. And then, you know, I'm a writer. I have a section in the book called The Math Packet about how Seth was our math guy. And I, one of the first things I thought is like, how am I going to help my kids with math? Because that's not my thing. My daughter is, she's majoring in public policy, but her minor is data science, is kind of, I mean, I kind of tease her because like there is no data science in my psyche, in my training, in anything. And I'm just like, that's her father, you know? And The other thing is, I would tell him how close they still are to his parents. Mm-hmm. I mean, that was a really important piece for me, that I didn't want to lose his family, you know, because we lost him. And so they're close with their, with his parents. His parents are still around and they have a deep bond with them. And, you know, I would just say you should be proud of these kids. I mean, even for the short time, the far too short time he was here, he had a deep and profound influence on them.
Wow. Thank you so
much. That's what I would say. Yeah.
So beautiful. There's so much to think in the ways that you're going to go out here with this book. And remember, you're the smart one with that red pen that's editing people's papers. So sometimes you're not as friendly, making sure that yes. You put the grammar in the comma, and you know, you forgot, you forgot this.
Yes. But
nevertheless, I see so much in what you can do. Do you see some public speaking? Do you see you?
Yeah. So I've done, I'm doing something, there's a nonprofit. I'm in Cambridge, Massachusetts. So there's a nonprofit here that supports women and girls' mental health. So I'm doing an event with them, with somebody from NPR. And I'm in talks actually with doing an event with the place that Julie and I went for our grief groups, to do something there. And I'm talking to other people. Yes, I really enjoy connecting with people of all ages who have been through this. And so, that's a really great avenue. And, you know, back to the idea of I'm not perfect. I just think that that's really important, and that we have these ideas of how we should live, and we all get derailed. And the thing is, you know, how do you respond to that derailing? And I will say that 5 years, you know, after Seth died, actually a couple years after Seth died, a friend of mine asked, "Do you want to meet another guy?" You know, and I was kind of like, oh man, am I allowed to be in some kind of romantic thing? Like, will that violate my vows? Anyway, to make a long romance shorter, 5 years after he died, I did remarry. And he's actually also a professor at MIT. And, you know, he has a daughter who's 6 months older than my older daughter. And the three of them, we figured out this blended family situation. And again, not always perfect, like three teenage girls sharing a bathroom, you can imagine. But, you know, they call each other sisters. And it's, you know, I never would have imagined this trajectory. And so you just don't know where life's going to go. I mean, it's true. We have very little control. And I think that the lesson is sort of to be open to joy and pleasure again, even though grief shuts you down, you know, in many ways.
Well, go ahead, girl. Keep at it. Before we let you go, the floor is yours. Tell our listeners something that you want them to remember about you, the movement, the book, and next steps in your life.
Yeah, I think we covered a lot, but I will say that, so actually the original working title of this book was The Good Suicide. And it was that, not because there was anything good about Seth's suicide. It was a disaster. It was life-changing in the most terrible ways. But the good in my mind was that my girls and I survived, right? And thrived after not thinking that was possible. And, you know, I changed the title for a bunch of reasons. But I still have that in my mind. And I do think, thinking about this idea of holding on to the good in what remains is kind of the moral of this story.
Rachel, thank you so much for sharing. And all of us out there who are listening, the moral of this story is grief, I'm not perfect. Not all solutions come from first this, then that, or I do, we do. True problem solving starts when we take accountability for ourselves. And right now, no excuses, my bad. Because on this platform it was built, because way too often as people, we were overlooked or labeled. But this is no longer our plight, and our fight is for anyone and everyone who feels a need to be understood. We are strong as individuals, but unstoppable when we unite. Tune in, friends, to another He's Just a Social Worker show, coming to another town near you real soon. We're out. Rachel, blessings. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I so enjoyed this conversation.
Please note that the views expressed here are my own and not a representation of my employers and clients. Thank you for listening. We're always here for you. Just message us and we'll get back to you within 24 hours. Thank you. More than just at He's Just a Social Worker. In memory of my mother, Matilde De La Rosa, this is dedicated to you, Mom. Miss you so much. En memoria de mi madre, Matilde De La Rosa, esto va dedicado a ti, mamá. Te extraño.